You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show, the World Food Programme runs out of supplies, the 50,000 ghost soldiers on the Iraqi military's payroll, and are we already at war with Russia? Plus, separated at birth?
Merhaba asker!
The Russian president visits his Turkish counterpart in Ankara. We'll ask if two adversaries have more in common than they'd probably care to admit. My studio guests Robert Fox and Daniela Peled will dissect these today's big stories. We'll also review some of London's new photo exhibitions and... A clip there from a film showing at London's Palestine Film Festival. Its organiser will join me in the studio. All that, plus we get the latest from our man in Budapest, and we play you a bit of music too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. But before all that, let's get the latest world news now. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thousands of Hong Kong pro-democracy activists have forced the temporary closure of government headquarters today after clashing with police, defying orders to retreat after more than 2 months of sustained protests in the Chinese-controlled city. Scores of protesters with wooden shields and metal barricades charged the police, who hit them with batons in a bid to push them back. 21-year-old student Rennie Lee says the police used unnecessary force.
We don't have any weapon, we have no weapon, but we try to use all the weapons to attack us. And so many people injured and they're breathing. And although we are breathing, many people are breathing, they don't have a sight to stop their violent actions.
The Ukrainian military spokesman Andrei Lysenko has accused Russian special forces on Monday of taking part in attacks on the strategically important Donetsk airport in eastern Ukraine, where fighting has intensified in recent days. Kiev also accused Russia of smuggling ammunition for heavy artillery into the area to step up the assault. There's been continued shelling from both sides, even after a ceasefire deal signed by Ukraine, Russia and separatist leaders on the 5th of September. Protesters in Washington today disrupted rush hour traffic in the heart of the Federal District to call for justice in the police shooting which killed an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri. A small group of protesters staged a so-called die-in and laid in the street in front of the Department of Justice. Meanwhile, the mayor of Ferguson, James Knowles, said he wanted to heal the rifts in the community.
Our number one goal is to bring together our police department and our community, to bridge the gap between those who feel there is a divide between them and law enforcement. I have convened a task force made up of residents, businesses, and law enforcement to create a civilian review board that will review complaints and provide citizen input to Ferguson police policies and procedures.
The Moldovan Liberal Democrat leader and former Prime Minister Vlad Filat said on Monday he was satisfied with the outcome of elections that appeared to give pro-European parties a majority coalition in the parliament. With 87% of the vote counted, the three parties, the Liberal Democrats, the Liberals and the Democrats, had a combined vote of 44%, enough to win a majority in the 101-seat parliament. This was in spite of the pro-Russian Socialist Party taking a surprise lead with 21.5% of the vote. Peruvian authorities have tightened security with the start today of the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference. Almost 200 nations are in Lima for the next 12 days to try and craft a new deal to limit rising greenhouse gas emissions, meant to be agreed upon at a summit in Paris in a year's time. Martin Kopp, a Luther Church official, offered a rather Buddhist view on climate change.
We need to change ourselves. Climate change is not only a question of techniques, it's also a question of values, it's a question of how do you look at the world, and we think that we should look at the world as something that is entrusted to us and we have to pass on to the next generations. So as a religious person, I would say to stop climate change, we need a change in ourselves. To stop the climate changing, we need us to change.
And finally, Florida authorities have vowed to capture a monkey last seen running through a Tampa neighborhood that they described as 3 foot tall, brown and fast. Tampa police said a resident went bananas when she saw the fleet-footed monkey running through her yard. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Robert Fox, defence editor at the London Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. Let's begin with a funding crisis at the World Food Programme. It's led to the closure of a food programme for refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria. The UN says it'll affect people in Lebanon, Jordan and Egypt. Families could go without food. We are heading into winter. Daniela, just listening to that, I was quite astonished at the fact that the programme just stops and people just go hungry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if this is a way to try and shame the international community into stepping up and funding this this programme. And the important thing about this is that it feeds, it literally feeds money back into the host country, because the neighbouring countries to Syria have had to absorb an astonishing amount of refugees. In places like Jordan, which is already largely a refugee community, are really struggling under this. And as you say, winter is coming, and domestic resentment at having to absorb this very taxing influx of people, it's not getting any easier.
Just let's look at the World Food Programme, Robert. It was funded by the United Nations at the instigation of the United States, but it is funded entirely from donations from countries, from governments and individuals and companies. How has it got to the stage whereby it's run out of money for one of its key projects?
This happens surprisingly often. It's neither here nor there, but just for me to bring it to reality, almost every very serious refugee crisis I've been in, whether in Europe, the Balkans, sometimes North Africa, but particularly Afghanistan, that's not meant to be a pun, but in 1989, 1988, just as the Russians were about to withdraw, there was jolly nearly famine in Kabul, and the WFP stepped in. And huge demands are made on it really quite quickly. And this is why you have got this rather strange system. It draws from the UN. It's an affiliate of the UN. But it really is for donor countries and high-minded organizations and even individuals to put their hands in their pocket. But I think that the real subset to this is exactly what Daniela is describing, is how critical the refugee crisis is. Refugees have been associated with so much of the story of the Middle East since it became an expression. But precisely, as you said, it's very, very interesting if you look at countries like Jordan and Lebanon, and also the permanent nature of refugee camps of the Palestinians, for example. That's the background. The foreground is that between a quarter and really heading above a third of the actual population of Lebanon today, and this has happened very suddenly, is refugee. There is a similar crisis way round, but also Jordan and Turkey are particularly critical in this respect. The problem I understand with many of the Syrian refugees, which is quite surprising at such a short space, is that there's very little aspiration to return. So you've got a permanency there. And this is why it is very interesting that this is flagged up. I'm sure this is it is absolutely what the WFP is saying, and worse. But there are so many problems behind it. That's why you're getting very odd bits of news suddenly coming out about border security and the border being closed. But we can go into that later. But it is because of the peculiarity of the Syrian exodus. So that a British diplomat, I forget the name, our last ambassador, in the UK's last ambassador in Damascus, Simon Collis, was telling me his wife is Syrian. Her friends say that, you know, they've destroyed the middle class, they've destroyed the intelligentsia, and the sad thing is there's little prospect very soon of that going back, whoever the regime is in Damascus.
Therefore, what is the purpose of the World Food Programme sending out this sign? I mean, Daniele, you mentioned a moment ago the idea of there are enough crises in the world. One could argue that Ebola has overtaken it in the immediate mindset of campaigns and you know, calls for donations. Is the World Food Programme really as serious as to say, as to put out a warning and actually stop a food programme? Because that just sounds slightly counterintuitive.
Well, look, the World Food Programme has got, you said Ebola is a very critical issue at the moment, but also it's working very hard places like South Sudan, which don't have as much media exposure. But I think it is a way of trying to make this relevant for governments. I mean, the European media has been obsessed with the idea of the risk that returning ISIS fighters, what kind of devastating effect that will have in European societies. But I think the greater danger is, for instance, returning to Jordan, where, as I understand it, that's the largest number of volunteers for ISIS. So if you have countries, which, as we've discussed, are already fairly tenuous, not necessarily a very cohesive, all kinds of internal strains and stresses, and you have a refugee crisis on top of that, and you have a financial crisis on top of that, and you have threat of returning jihadis. I mean, this is not a problem that the World Food Programme can solve, and it does make me kind of cross when certain politicians, certain quarters, refer to what's happening in Syria as a humanitarian crisis. I remember Ed Miliband, following the gas attacks, rather weaselly described it as a humanitarian crisis. But it's not a tsunami, it's not a flood, it's not an earthquake, it's a civil war which has resulted in a humanitarian crisis, and the humanitarian issue, and that's not the way that this is going to be resolved.
Those issues to one side, though, Robert, you do have an immediate problem that you have hundreds of thousands of people who require feeding. There is not enough food. It is heading into winter, regardless of the permanency or the transient nature of their stay. To what degree are governments going to have to step up to the mark here and solve an immediate problem?
Well, actually, there is a point in referring to it as a humanitarian crisis, because this is the way, sorry, it sounds balmy to be mentioning this at the moment, this is the way international law is moving, because international law has moved away from humanitarian intervention. We've had Blair's speech at Chicago justifying NATO actions in Kosovo, and then it was used in spades for the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And everybody's saying, no, that's not right. They went wrong, particularly the latter in Iraq. It's egregious, it amounts to occupation. Where does the law take us on that? But the big appeal is this formula of an extreme humanitarian emergency of global reference. And I think that's what they're putting at here. But this is where I absolutely find myself totally in agreement with Daniela, the way this is being categorized at the moment, as if we can do it as a refugee problem and we've got to stop refugees. And the problem that I find absolutely heartbreaking, but also wildly unrealistic, of them saying WFP can't feed them, we're closing the borders to refugees. The Turks have tried to do it for very political reasons to the north. And lo and behold, we see in the Daily Telegraph, I haven't lost my mind, I may sound as if I have, British aid plus military forces have covertly built 12 watchtowers in the Bekaa Valley to protect Baalbek. And it's the same mentality. You can stop refugees and you can stop migration by hard power, which is playing against the domestic political agenda, as we know only too well, UK, France, Germany, but also in the USA. And I think it is such an epistemological, it's a philosophical nonsense. And it's time we looked at the very, very serious problems in realistic terms. This is an appeal, though. You're right, Emma, in saying it this is an appeal. Christmas is coming. Put your hand in your pocket. There's a bit of jingling in the background, Bob Geldof, and I don't mean to be cynical about it, but there's a lot of PR pushing and pulling
not
there.
Not to be cynical about Bob Geldof.
Not to be cynical. Mr. Geldof will deal with another day. But, I mean, it is really at the
Sir
end...
Sir Bob, please.
Sir Bob. I'm doffing my cap now. I mean, at the end of the day, it is, as you say, a very simple problem of people needing to be fed. Do you think people are getting bogged down in the politics and just the fact that people are unwilling now to get involved?
Inevitably so, and I suspect Daniela understands the mechanics of this better than I do, because I've seen this happening, and I never know in all the refugees. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't have the wisdom of Methuselah, but I've seen a lot in my time as an international journalist, and you never quite fathom why things, why scares, why panics, and this is justified, suddenly get triggered off. Is it a political mechanism? Are we being sent different kinds of messages? These unfortunate people need to be fed and covered for this winter, which it may sound you're not, because you're not far from the shores of the Mediterranean, but it can be very, very harsh indeed.
Let's turn next to Iraq, where up to 50,000 so-called ghost soldiers have been removed from the military's payroll. It's the latest sign that the Iraqi army, trained in theory to protect the country after the departure of US troops, isn't up to scratch, because, of course, the rise of the so-called Islamic State is argued to have happened so quickly, in part due to the Iraqi troops simply running away. Robert Fox and Daniela Pellid join me still. I mean, Daniela, when I wasn't madly surprised when I read this, the idea of ghost soldiers graft within an enormously amorphous military.
No, I have to say, I wasn't either. You'd be more surprised by the absence of corruption in many armies, administrations around the world. But also, what kind of tickled me is the way that Haider al-Abadi sort of took personal credit for this. He announced it to the parliament. He said, I have looked through all the records. I found 50,000. There may be more. I mean, he's been in power for what? Less than 3 months. He's got an enormous task, an enormous mission. Security is top of that. He's already sacked a whole load, I think nearly 40 last month of top commanders. More to come. This is, I'm sure, this is only the tip of the iceberg. And this is corruption is by far from the worst problem that he inherits, in the army even. But I think this is also part of him saying, right, this is what I'm doing. I'm putting down a mark. I'm going to fight corruption, combine it with security, two watchwords. Yeah, let's see what happens next.
Robert, a couple of weeks ago, I saw a glass case containing an Iraqi machine gun, and there was a quote underneath it, an engraving placed there by a member of the US Air Force that said, Iraqi gun dropped once, never used. To what degree is this seen as an endemic problem in the Iraqi military?
I think it's been a colossal problem, but I think it's more serious than that, is that the Brits and the Americans, but above all the Americans, put millions, possibly nay billions, into rebuilding this army, and nobody seems to have audited it. If there is corruption, and it's not overt corruption often, but it is covert corruption, there has been real corruption with private military companies, trainers, and so on. You must audit all the way through. It sounds very pompous to say that. But this is why we have ended up with a $1 trillion war in Afghanistan, and we don't know where the hell half the money has gone. This certainly happened with the Iraqi forces. The point about what happened at Mosul was they had four divisions. They were opposed by maximum 1,500 ISIS, and they ran away. I talked to a British general very senior British general who has a direct input to what is going on to Iraq. He said, well, I always knew it's just a checkpoint and therefore checkbook in metaphor army. If you train yourself up to run a checkpoint, you obviously run it for a very good reason. By the way, and much the same has happened in Afghanistan as well. But we're supposed to go goo-goo when we're told how much aid UK, US, France, Germany, the main donors have put into it. We are very, very bad at auditing it. But I think the manoeuvre with the Prime Minister saying, I am not my predecessor, it's very clever. It's sending a message
the subtlety of which we can only begin to get the glimmer of. This is a message going to Iran. It's going to the Shiite community. It's going to the Sunni community that he can win over. What he is really showing is, actually, I am no pushover and I am here for the long haul.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, joined by Daniela Pellet and Robert Fox.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Daniela Pellet and Robert Fox. Now, Russia has accused NATO of trying to destabilise Northern Europe. It says that military drills and the use of aircraft capable of carrying nuclear weapons are a reality which is extremely negative. Daniela Pellet, is this a case of pot calling kettle black, surely?
It's a kind of case of, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? I mean, this is a very binary, seen in a very binary way. That is the way that Russia is viewing the West and the awful NATO aggression, and how very dare they enter into our sphere of influence. Obviously, the view from the other side sees it rather differently.
Robert, what is it about Russia and its preoccupation with NATO? I mean, is it still such an existential threat?
It's an obsession with Putin, for a start, and his whole foreign policy is based on this. And Yabu, you know, stop being so aggressive and you're destabilising Europe. I love it. But the fun thing is what really happened at Brisbane and what Obama and Cameron really said to Putin, which so upset him. And they said the following to him. They said, we know your war plan. We've been looking at it since January. You're going to take out the east of Ukraine, either metaphorically or physically. And we know that your pals, if not you yourself, were involved in the massive hack on the biggest bank in America, JP Morgan, getting into 83 million personal accounts from July through to August. We regard that as an act of war. Now think on. And he stumped off.
Just looking at the way that Putin seems to be approaching his foreign policy by all manner, as Robert has just described, I think I was wondering whether people actually get him wrong. They underestimate Putin, that they think that he's trying to adhere to an ideology. In fact, he's behaving nothing more than like a czar.
I mean, I think my personal view from the beginning of this crisis has always been that it's not a strategy so much, and he's feeling his way through, or a tactician rather than a strategist. What's been happening is you're seeing how far he can push it, how far Russia can go. I mean, Crimea was lost within 5 minutes. That was interesting. I think they were rather encouraged by that. But it is a complicated situation because Europe is very firmly entangled with Russian interests. I don't think it's quite as straightforward as that. But it is about Putin's personal obsessions. I agree. It's about his philosophy, and this philosophy, this kind of attitude towards the West and the terribly decadent West, which has been part of his I think we can say reign, can't we?
I think I don't know how to dispute it. I mean, just listening to what other countries have said in response to what is happening. I mean, you mentioned the fact that Cameron and Obama took Putin to one side and said, we know that you or one of your cronies launched this cyber attack. You have Jens Stoltenberg, who's urging Russia to improve the humanitarian efforts in eastern Ukraine. shake, you know, I'm shrugging my shoulders in that. We have Sweden now polling to feel more tempted to join NATO. We have the Germans saying that actually, no, we don't ever see Ukraine ever moving into NATO. There are so many different messages being said by so many different people, but no one seems to have taken a concerted line towards Russia and towards Putin.
They have very different approaches. But part of the problem is that NATO really does look like an old crock now. It looks completely out of date. It really is a Cold War instrument. It was very successful, if you like that kind of thing, and supported in grinding this thing, this awful, terrible waste of money in confrontation to a halt. It didn't lead to a hot war. But a defensive military alliance isn't very good to do the all-singing, all-dancing things that you need. Applehood and Mother Pie, you might even say, and something like the OSCE is much more useful. So you've got to get behind that. But Putin, holigalightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, do you know why she wasn't a phony? Because she was really phony about the things she was phony about. That's Putin. Putin believes in national unity. He believes in the mystical future of Russia. And there's a sort of bonkers approach to, including the Disneyland iconography of it, to the church.
Okay, we will return to Putin and his personality in a few moments' time. But briefly, let's sandwich in some Swiss news. They have rejected...
Swiss roll.
I build them up. The Swiss have rejected a severe curb on immigration this weekend. It's held in one of their regular referendums. An anti-immigration group called Ecopop had called for the number of people being allowed to settle in Switzerland to be cut harshly. I mean, it was an excellent bit of democracy by the Swiss this weekend. 74% said no. Let's keep immigration as it is.
Yes. Now, I wouldn't want to be accused of cynicism, especially when it comes to the Swiss. But I wouldn't say that they have exemplified themselves as hugely sort of tolerant and welcoming of other cultures and ethnicities nation. I mean, we remember the notorious 2009 referendum on minarets, which banned any minarets from being built in Sweden, as in Switzerland. Of course, they had the huge number of four at the time. So obviously, it was an enormous threat to Swiss nationhood. I think really, yeah, immigration has been very good for the Swiss economy. It's simple as that. It's simple as that. I don't think this shows any great change or any great more openness to Europe, to immigration. It's been very good, thank you very much, and the status quo doesn't really need changing.
Robert, how much is this an exploration by the Swiss as to just how much they can deal with the immigration question? I think it was earlier on this year that they voted in another referendum to place quotas on their immigration levels, which of course sets them on a complete collision course with the European Union. But is this a country trying to pick its way through a problem that all the other nations would rather like to address in the same manner?
Well, they wouldn't have a league of football teams if they didn't have immigration. And that's a silly remark that has quite a serious side. It's they could do it by work permits and visas, which actually happens a lot here on the UK or on that side. Yes, I think we're going to hear a lot about quotas. No, do I think that it's going to work in the long term? You've heard me, I've bored the listeners to death about it. Hard power cannot be used against the flow of people. And this is the thing that however much somebody like Obama tries to be liberal about immigration, people will move. And it's the increasing number of people on the move in the planet, actually, the great brains in Whitehall, Westminster, Geneva, Kremlin land even, they really can't cope with, because that's really the story with Russia again, is that the Russians are outnumbered.
Let us return then for the final minutes that we have in this discussion about President Putin. Now, these two men may be at odds over Ukraine, Syria and Iran, but are Russia's President Vladimir Putin and his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan long-lost political twins? There has been years of estrangement between Russia and Turkey, of course, but as ever, trade trumps politics and the two countries have been busy, have business to do and energy to supply. The two men are meeting as we speak. And in terms of the way they govern, are these two men who are separated at birth. Robert, both men, wary of the West. These are just a quick jotting I made before we came on. Well, no, wary of the West, prone to nationalism a little bit, dreadful repression of the press, and like to be both president and prime minister and outstay their welcome. To what degree are these two men cut from the same cloth?
And have mega personality cults. One has a rather sentimental attitude to the Orthodox Church. The other is a very serious Muslim
of a Sunni Muslim of a kind that the outside world has completely underestimated.
Daniela, what would you say to that?
Well, it is astonishing, despite how they, in terms of their foreign policy, how divided they would appear on it. They've managed to stay best buddies. I can very much imagine them, you know, enjoying a Turkish bath or a sauna, you know, beating each other with birch twigs. Perhaps I better stop there.
No, please do carry on. But just thinking about the way that the West should treat these two men, because the more that these two men and their countries are alienated from Europe, from the rest of the world, how much closer do you think that these two men could actually work together, and should the West really, really underestimate them?
No, I think the West, look, the West decided that to turn its back on Turkey, to put it bluntly and very crudely. It wasn't the experience with Russia isn't quite the same. But yeah, I mean, there's an enormous amount of similarities, and I think perhaps their relations, I think the cult of personality and two very strong, domestically popular leaders can do quite a lot to drive their countries together on a mutual path.
Robert, are the West underestimating what these two men could really talk about when they're in the bath?
Trouble for NATO. And also Putin would court, he's got to court Turkey, he's got to court Erdogan, because he is the most implacable enemy of Hafez al-Assad, which is important. And could it be, remember I talked about the balance of populations, could it be that might like a little bit of help with the Caucasus, the boiling Caucasus, where things are really on the move and we don't hear nearly enough about it? I think they're all the funny talk that we've just done, I think there's a cold steel eyeball to eyeball here. We have got a security interest in common, and these two will get to that very quickly.
Thank you very much indeed to you both. Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Robert Fox, who's defence editor at the London Evening Standard. Thank you for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll review new photo exhibitions in London, we'll check in with what's going on in the Palestinian film scene, and we'll also speak to our man in Budapest. That's just around the corner. Before that, Jonathan has the latest news.
Thank you very much. Thousands of Hong Kong pro-democracy activists have forced the temporary closure of government headquarters today after clashing with police, defying orders to retreat after more than 2 months of sustained protests in the Chinese-controlled city. The Ukrainian military spokesman has accused Russian special forces on Monday of taking part in attacks on the strategically important Donetsk airport in eastern Ukraine. Protesters in Washington have today disrupted rush hour traffic in the heart of the federal district to call for justice in the police shooting which killed an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri. And Peruvian authorities have tightened security with the start today of the annual UN Climate Change Conference. Almost 200 nations are in Lima for the next 12 days to try and craft a new deal to limit rising greenhouse gas emissions. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
And And my thanks to Jonathan Wheatley. He'll be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, Robert Bound will be unpacking a brand new fresh episode of Culture here on Monocle 24 at 1900 hours London time. It will all be about orchestras. But welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. The time in Moscow is 21:34. It's 18:34 here in London, 16:34 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents. Today we head to Hungary, where our man in Budapest, Adam Labor, awaits us. A very warm welcome to the programme, Adam. You wanted to talk about Hungary retreating from Putin.
Yes, well, Prime Minister Viktor Orban has been under a lot of pressure lately for a perceived turn towards Russia. He's been rather lukewarm about sanctions on Ukraine. And also earlier this year, Hungary signed a deal in secret for 10 billion euros for a 10 billion euro loan from Russia to revamp the Paks nuclear power station. And there's been other indications of a kind of rapprochement between Budapest and Moscow. This has not gone down very well at all, especially with all the conflict in Ukraine.
I mean, so they're moving away from Russia. That is a dangerous thing to do in the current climate, isn't it?
Well, they've been coming under a lot of pressure from other countries in the EU for being too pro-Russia and for being too cosy with the Russians when the EU is bringing sanctions on. And what we saw lately, very recently, was Mr. Orban saying, you know, he's fully committed to Ukrainian territorial integrity. He went to Lithuania. You know, the Baltic states are all very nervous about Russia at the moment, fearing that they might be next after Ukraine for some kind of, you know, conflict. And he was there, Mr. Orban, you know, standing side by side with the Lithuanian president. And there's been a definite repositioning away from Moscow and more to Berlin. And one assumes that he's been told behind the scenes, almost certainly by the Germans, that actually, you know, when you're a member of the European Union, you can't really run your own independent foreign policy.
To what degree do you therefore think that actually the relationship with Germany will be Hungary's future?
Oh, very much so. I mean, Hungary's economy is absolutely tied to the German economy, and a large part of the Hungarian GDP is produced by German factories, German car manufacturers that are based in Budapest, based in Hungary, manufacturing car parts here. There's a lot of German investments. There's historical ties that, you know, go back more than 100 years, and so I think Hungary is very much linked to Germany, and probably Angela Merkel is one of the few foreign leaders that Mr. Orban would probably listen to if she tells him that he's going down the wrong path.
The trouble is it too late? Because if you have Hungary owing Russia so much money, I think it's $14 billion that they borrowed in January to expand their nuclear program, there's going to be a gas pipeline coming through the country which will carry Russian gas to Europe by circumventing Ukraine. And is there a possibility that Viktor Orban has done this a little bit too late?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a bit of a mating dance, really, you know, that he moves towards Russia as far as he can and then gets told off and then moves back and then probably in a little while might move forward again. I mean, you know, in the country's defence, I mean, you have to look at it on a map. As I think Bismarck said, geography dictates history. So, you know, Hungary can't really, it's a small country, you know, less people live here than live in Greater London. It can't really kind of declare economic war on Russia, and nor should it, but, and it always will be doing a balancing act. But there was a definite sense that, you know, the pendulum had swung the wrong way, to mix up my metaphors a bit.
Okay, well, let's move on to a subject which is very dear to European shoppers' heart, and one wonders whether this next subject is something which is going to put Hungary on a collision course with the European Union. The government party wants to ban Sunday shopping, something that was fought for very hard in the European courts.
Yes, this is a kind of slightly odd thing, and we've been trying to work out what this is about. I mean, it may be that the government has been very much launching heavy taxes on the retail sector, especially foreign retail companies, who have been charged backdated taxes along with telecommunications and banking, and they're hitting them hard. But I mean, if you look in Hungarian shops on Sundays, they're crowded. I mean, the people go shopping on Sundays, and this idea that, you know, you shouldn't have Sunday shopping is terribly out of date. You know, and at the moment they're saying, okay, if it's a family-owned shop and the, someone from the family or a family member is working in the shop, it can stay open. But I mean, what does that mean? What, you know, you're going to start passing a law saying, you know, a grandson or a third cousin. I mean, what's the definition of someone in the family? It's just all terribly old-fashioned, really.
So where are they getting support for this idea?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, the government has actually lost a third of its support, according to one poll, in the last month, because of various alleged corruption scandals, and there's a big row going on with America as well. And it seems that, you know, the Fidesz bubble might have popped, actually, although there were three elections this year, national, local and European, and they won all of them, but partly because the opposition is in such a sorry state. But it may be that there's a bit of a shift coming on here. So I just don't see what the electoral win is in this at all.
I was going to wonder, you know, what are Fidesz worried that they will lose or gain by putting this forward?
Well, I think they generally have a lot of rhetoric against multinational companies. Most of the supermarkets here are Austrian or German or French owned, or there's Tesco as well. And you know, perhaps there's a feeling that they can protect the Hungarian small shops.
Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we check in on the Palestinian film scene. Stay tuned.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time in Istanbul is 2041, 1841 here in London. This is Emma Nelson. Now, London Palestine Film Festival launched on Friday, and during the course of 2 weeks, it'll show as many as 40 works of film and video by Palestinian and international artists. Well, to tell us more, Shema Bouali is one of the festival organisers, and she joins me now to tell us more about some of the highlights and a little bit more about the Palestinian film scene more widely. Welcome, Shaila. Okay, explain to someone who may never have seen a Palestinian film. How could I tell it was one if I watched it?
What the Palestine Film Festival focuses on is more international films that focus on Palestine as a history or a topic or an idea. What a Palestinian film itself would be... Actually, funny enough, there's a documentary that's on exactly that topic tonight at the Barbican called Cinema Palestine, where a bunch of popular Palestinian directors speak about what their notion is. And I don't know, it's hard to define a certain national cinema, but I guess it would be in the Arabic language. It would probably take place there. Because Palestinians are such a diasporic people, it really is very hard to define as a national cinema, which is why it's a big question.
It was a very unfair question on my part, because if you asked me to define the cinema of many nations, I think I would find myself coming very, very unstuck. But you mentioned the fact that you have international filmmakers bringing their work to the film festival. What kinds of subject matters are they dealing with, and what treatments are they giving to them?
Well, we have a really wide variety this year, especially. I mean, we had a family adventure about a young boy trying to save the last giraffe after an airstrike. We had a dark comedy about these three spinster sisters that are trying to hang on to their social position in society. We also have a surreal drama coming up. We have documentaries. And so all of these filmmakers, they come from France, they come from Iran, they come from the US, They deal with different issues of exile, refugees, incarceration, but also, you know, humanity and love and human stories.
It's good that you mention that idea of humanity and love and the day-to-day life of, you know, the women who you speak of who are trying not to lose their social standing. I think it is possibly a huge issue in terms of the international community will think of Palestine and they will just think of the problems that are associated with it. To what degree do filmmakers have to fight a little bit harder to make a different story get heard?
Well, I mean, you actually, you're getting a lot of different stories these days. I mean, we have a short story coming up that's this kind of off-the-whack stoner caper film by these young filmmakers in Ramallah, and it's this sort of dream-like escapade around the city. So it doesn't really look at the occupation or any kind of political slant as such, but obviously it's in the background because that's where you are and that's everyday life. But you get such a different kind of array of films. So this one that I'm talking about, Pink Bullet, it's a short film by a young director, but it's very edgy. So it's not really a political film at all, you know?
Well, let's deal with one. Well, there is a political film that I think you wanted to talk about in a moment, but staying on the theme of everyday life being documented, there's a film that's being shown called Strip Life, which is about manta rays being washed ashore. Tell us about this film.
Well, this film actually starts with this surreal vision of manta rays washing up on the water. But then it continues as a sort of observational documentary about Gaza. It's called Strip Life, and it's part of a triple bill that we're screening on Gaza specifically. And this one was made in 2013, and it just follows these three or four different people on their daily life. One works at a radio station, in fact, and another's a photographer, one's a fisherman. But yeah, it does start with this sort of surreal image of all these different manta rays washed up on Gaza Beach.
Well, let's have a little listen to this. Obviously, layers of sound there being played. It gives you the impression that it is very observational. You're just bringing in a daily life in Gaza there.
Yeah, you get a lot of really beautiful images of the place, of the people, of the city, of the nature. And it's a very unique sort of way of picturing Gaza because, you know, unfortunately, we're not used to seeing Gaza as a normal place. It's usually seen with a lot of destruction. But this film presents it in a very beautiful sort of daily life kind of frame, a very calm place.
Well, we are going to return to, you know, not daily life, but Palestine being a very not calm place this film. Mars at Sunrise, this again is perhaps the subjects that the international community would often associate Palestine with, which is conflict, torture, you know, war.
Yeah, this film is the director's debut feature, Jessica Habib. She's made this film based on the testimony of Hani Zarab, who's an artist who actually was incarcerated, and she's made this very surreal, dreamlike film based on what she knows about his experience. And it's basically about the prisoner
What happened to it? This is a Palestinian painter who's taken prisoner and is subsequently tortured by an Israeli soldier.
Yeah. So he sort of sees him at a checkpoint, and all of a sudden his memories all start coming back. So throughout the whole film, you're not sure where you're into a dream, into a memory. And then you kind of also realize that the soldier is also an artist. And so they start to meet each other. And it's a very beautifully, visually, very aesthetically beautiful, bold-colored film, and it's a very interesting take on how the human mind goes between creativity and incarceration.
Let's have a quick listen. Violence there obviously being part and parcel of that film. That was a clip in Arabic, but it was in Arabic and Hebrew. To what degree is there a sort of a big language problem or language journey that you must take when you're trying to deal with films in Palestine?
Well, I guess you get a lot of films that are in Arabic with some Hebrew and some English thrown in, maybe other languages too. We have a French film coming up actually called Encounters of the Lost Land, and that's entirely in French and in English. French and in Arabic. But a lot of subtitles. You know, especially if you don't speak either.
Simple as that. Yeah. Just lots of subtitles.
Yeah.
Seamer Bwali, one of the organisers of the London Palestine Film Festival. It runs until December the 11th, is that right?
That's right.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you.
In just a moment, we'll be reviewing London's new photo exhibitions, taking us there for no reason other than the fact that we've once fancied playing it. This is Delight.
We're going to dance. We're going to dance. We're going to dance. And have some fun.
Satisfaction when we're done, satisfaction of what's to come. I couldn't ask for another.
That's right.
Your groove, I do deeply dig. No walls, only the bridge. My supper dish, my succotash wish.
Sing it, baby.
I couldn't ask for another.
Delight there, Groove is in the Heart, 1852 here in London. Let's have a look at what's happening in London's photography world. For that, we're joined by the photography critic, Sue Stewart. And welcome to the studio, Sue. Good to see you. Let us begin with the National Portrait Gallery with the Taylor Wessing Portrait Prize.
Yes, this is the annual prize at the National Portrait Gallery, as opposed to the BP painting portraits, which are very similar, actually. What happens is that you get a short list of four, and then there is an extra one, which is the John Cobell Award, and there's 60 every year of the photographs. The first prize was very interesting, actually. Somebody called David Titlow, and he'd worked out this kind of grouping of a mother with the child and a friend, and he was actually the photographer as well. And the little baby was looking at a dog and trying to get his hand onto the dog. But the way it's constructed and composed is very much based on the whole idea of Caravaggio's paintings, and the light comes in on it and hits on the child's hand and so on. It's a very beautiful painting photograph. composed in that way. And then another one was a Mexican cook in Mexico City in a cafe, and she was in the exact lighting position of Vermeer. So those two are actually very unusual. I mean, you don't usually get that kind of effect.
You don't get that kind of self-conscious use of painting either in photography all that much. I mean, I'm just looking at the picture now, which is a David Titlow photograph.
Yes.
And yes, you do think immediately that this is a Caravaggio, because you not only have the activity of the little boy reaching out to touch the dog's nose, you also have the audience of the family members. But in the background, you have little bits that give you an indication of what might have been happening the night before.
Yes.
Or just now. It's a very strange place that they find themselves. This tenderness of the children. But they're all surrounded by drinks cans.
Yes, exactly. They do say that, actually, in the text afterwards. But it does look like that, yes. Whereas the one with the cook in the Mexican cafe was very, very different. I mean, she was just in the centre of it, and the light just came in. That very, very minimal. You wouldn't expect it to be a cafe. Chef's room at all.
How much is this worth a visit? I mean, you're talking about the National Portrait Gallery, which is constantly having prizes for the latest best portraits. How does this stand out from the others?
I would say that this is... I was a judge one year, and I've written about it every single year, and I would say that this is the best there's been so far. And it's ironic because Sandy Nairn, the director of the gallery, is leaving, so this is his last attendance of it. But I think there's just something changed, which the kind of... the clichés of it became sort of red-headed girls and very sort of deadpan teenagers, and now it's moved into something like this, which is very composed. And there's a girl there called a skate girl who's from Kabul and the skateboards. And they brought in different people. I mean, that is actually Jessica Fulford Dobson is from this country, but there's a lot of photographers coming in from around the world as well. And the whole thing has changed very much, actually. I think the subjects have gone wider, and it's just much more interesting. And it's been painted differently. It's got an atmosphere that just notices change.
Let's move on to another exhibition which has started. Now, you're talking, you're in the same room as a woman who's just dusted off her CD player and brought it out of retirement. Such is my disillusionment with the digital way we listen to music. This exhibition is a return to analogue photography.
Yes, actually. There's two things here that are analogue photography. This is Hiroshi Sugimoto, who is one of the greatest of Japanese photographers and a very interesting man. He's very broad-ranging in the subjects that he does, from sort of landscapes and seascapes, theatres and so on, and also known entirely always black and white photography. This particular one at the Pace Gallery in London is called Still Life, which is ironic, really, because still life in French and the French way of talking about still lives is nature mort. So this is about dead nature as well as still life. And what he's done is he went to the museum, the Natural History Museum in New York, which is where they have dioramas. And dioramas are those kind of stage sets of animals against a backdrop, stuffed animals against a backdrop that was hand-painted. And what he's done, I mean, these have been going for decades and decades in the museums around America and different places. But what he's done is he's photographed those settings and created something which looks very strange when you get close to it. But actually, from a distance, it looks extremely beautiful and quite innovative. But there's one or two. The first one from 1976 was actually a polar bear looking down at a dead seal that presumably was waiting to be eaten. But it's completely unconvincing. Whereas the one where he's done in 1994, which is Alaskan wolves, is a real classic thing about the way he does tones within black and white and greys. And he's got all these wolves on the side of a grass. And it does look as if it's very realistic, actually.
The pictures are astonishing. I mean, just looking at the exhibition that's at least at the Pace Gallery. They just seem to be so different in terms of their subject matter. There doesn't seem to be any one theme. Yes, perhaps we could say natural world, but only in its absolutely loosest sense.
Yes, exactly. And then you see the forest. There's two very, very big prints. These are all huge photographs. And you see those, and that's, it doesn't seem like it's connected at all because it doesn't have that kind of depth to it or the animals in it.
Is there any particular way in which he produces these pictures that differs from the traditional way of photography, if there is such a thing as a traditional way of photography?
I think the most important thing is the way he deals with the printing, actually, the use of the tones. He's famous for that tonality, and that appears all the way through. But, I mean, the backdrops were meticulously painted by people who were scientists who were working to get the exact details of these mountain backdrops and so on, and the seas as well.
And that's Hiroshi Sugimoto. Thank you very much indeed, Sue Stewart, for coming in to bring us the latest in photography. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Pellet and Robert Fox. My thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jonathan Bartlett, and our studio managers, Antonio Fernandez and Sean Miller.
heavy. Next up, after the headlines, Culture with Robert Bound has an orchestral theme this week. Then at 2200 hours, listen to the Monocle Daily if you can, with Nancy Durham and Dominic Reynolds, your host. This show will be back at 1800 hours London time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.